You could be having a nice nap and sleeping and all that stuff, but you're here talking to me, blah, 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 and instead of resting. So we appreciate it. Thank you, Tarek. Tarek, do you want to introduce yourself and say a little bit about what you do and who you are?
My name is Tarek Labani. I'm an emergency physician. I work both in the Gaza Strip and in London, Ontario, in Canada. My major work has to do with trying to ensure that Palestinians enjoy the same kind of medical care and health that my patients in Canada do. And that rub, the idea that I'm in Gaza and I can't give people the same care I know I can give just one day's travel away, that's the thing that bothers me and animates me. I am Palestinian. I'm a Palestinian refugee and was born a refugee who was stateless with just papers that say, hey, this boy exists. But having said that, my connection to Palestine, I guess my dirty little secret is I don't really give a shit about Palestine. Palestine is a really interesting place that sort of meets the three main criteria that I have for working somewhere. It's a place that has need, it's a place that has potential, and it's a place that I can participate in. There are lots of places that have a need but don't necessarily have a potential. And there are lots of places that have those first two things where I'm either not able or not desired. I've been to countries before. For example, when I worked in Iraq, I was frankly told, you have no role here, get out of here. They weren't ready or willing to have international solidarity workers coming from outside when I was working at that time. So those are the three reasons why, or the three things that kind of made me think of Gaza. Now, the need, everybody knows why there's a need. But I think what happens is sometimes people get obscured from the potential. Gaza is a place where a relatively small amount of work can produce a relatively large amount of results. And that's a pretty tremendous potential. It's teetering on liberation. It's just absolutely close to freedom. And sometimes I think people miss how close it is. And a lot of that has to do with lots of factors. Palestinians in Gaza were basically locked up. The key was thrown. They were left to their own devices. Every once in a while, just like in any prison, they would be taken out for a beating. But other than that, they've been able to kind of construct and build and make and be. And that's really special. And every once in a while, when things change in Egypt, there's a bit of a shot, like an adrenaline shot in the arm. I mean, the years between 2011 and 2013 until that coup were incredible for Gaza's growth as a quasi-state. And of course, in terms of ability, well, I worked very hard after I graduated because I had an education to become a doctor and to look at the health conditions there and how it is that I can participate in the health sector, which seems to be a good way for me to both be able to go there and to actually do something that they want me to participate in.
So there's a lot of different ways we can kind of go from here, because I'm curious to sort of speak to you about what you think about the role of medicine in resistance struggles. The obvious analog, the first person to think of is Che Guevara. And I'm not comparing you to Che Guevara, obviously, in a sense, but someone who sort of saw medicine as a gateway to sort of revolutionary struggle. Maybe not. Maybe if he was like a car mechanic, he also would have ended up a revolutionary. So I don't know. We can sort of get into that. But maybe before getting into that, we can stay on the question of Gaza and see about like this. Since 2006, what has, what you just said is very interesting to me, is that they've developed those 2 years, the years from the fall of, oh my God, who was the guy in Egypt? I forget his name, Hosni Mubarak, and the reinstantiation of the Egyptian military through Sisi. So you're saying those 2 years were interesting. I guess you've also seen in this time Gaza's growth as a kind of state entity, and however much, it's corralled and besieged by essentially like the world. But, you know, the it must have been an interesting thing to watch develop over the years. But I guess your own trajectory took you around a bunch of other countries. But what can you say about Gaza in the last 15 years that people may not understand from the typical things we hear about it, which is usually in the context of a war or some report or, you know, kind of part of the constant bad news flow from Palestine?
I think it kind of sounds like I'm trying to exercise some unnecessary positivity sometimes. But I think the main thing people don't appreciate about Gaza is both how beautiful it is, just stunningly gorgeous as a piece of land, and also how rich it is in terms of its natural resources and in terms of its human resources. Gaza has never had a problem of riches, even despite how hard they've been blockaded and oppressed. And Gaza's also always been stunningly gorgeous, despite how little resources they have for upkeep and maintenance. And those two things are significant because very often in some of these struggles, there are places where by dint of the colonial setup and border setting, there are no riches, there are no exploitable resources. And that makes the struggle 10 times harder. Whereas if I were to go into Gaza and say, I want $5 million for a project, the limits are not the $5 million. The limits are the banks, the borders, the threat of arrest in Israel, in Canada, in the United States, in Europe. And that's not because this money is illegal. The money is basically would be tax money from the government that's there, that is, or from the natural riches that are there. That's because there has been a concerted international decision. It's not a conspiracy. It's not anything like some people sitting in back rooms. These guys are declaring it on CNN and on Fox. They're saying when, for example, in Canada, I think it was Peter McKay at the time, the foreign minister of Canada, he didn't sit in a smoky room and say, let's fuck over those Palestinians. He went on CBC and said not one red cent to the Palestinians after Hamas won election. So these are the things that really damage the Palestinians. It's a concerted international effort. And that doesn't make Palestinian struggle better than the struggle of people who have no natural resources. That just makes it different because we have to look at that situation and try to attack in a very real way what's happening outside. But also we can recognize that actually we can create a society that's almost totally independent inside. And so that's why lots of my work there really functionally is in thinking, how can I create a world that I want to live in, a place that is just and verdant, a place that I can be proud of participating in. When that can happen, you can have an almost completely independent society inside Gaza. And when you work on that, when you're trying to triangulate that particular angle, what you're also doing is creating a place that is incompatible with not what colonialism is today, but with what post-colonialism will be tomorrow. There are lots of people working on liberation, and that is the sexiest struggle. It is not at all sexy to think, how can we ensure that WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, or the WTO, or the IMF, have no surface on which to stick on the morning after liberation? That's not at all sexy, but it's essential. So we have a place with enough resources, enough organization, and enough intelligence. And I don't mean intelligence in the sense of innate available intelligence. There are lots of people who've never spent a day in school who are incredibly brilliant. But I'm I'm also talking about a different kind of intelligence. Almost all Palestinians have degrees. Almost all Palestinians are very highly educated. PhDs there, I have more friends with PhDs there than I have friends with PhDs here. The only thing that is that I guess is common between them is just that, they have a love for education. But people there really value that formalized education because they can't develop their wealth in the traditional ways, so they get educated. And of course, Palestinian culture focuses on that. So you have all of the resources to make that society, but also you have a lot of competing visions. And the reason why Hamas is successful is because they present the most palatable and the most realistic vision right now for what that country can be. And when they compete against Fatah, their vision is much more appealing to people. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're genuinely not corrupt in the traditional ways that we think about it. They're the way that I started to think about it when I started to understand the corruption of Hamas is, okay, they're corrupt in the same way that Doug Ford is corrupt. They're not corrupt in the same way that Mugabe is corrupt. And that is the way in which Fatah is corrupt. They're corrupt like Mugabe, not like Ford. So,
But Mugabe actually did something, though. Fatah, like, I don't know. I guess the analogy to me is a little dangerous
Fatah
because,
did something. I mean,
well,
Fatah has accomplished a lot.
I guess that's an insult to Fatah. But I guess I mean that for me, looking at Oslo and the good work of Fatah. I mean, I'm a child of Oslo in the sense that, like, I grew up watching the Oslo peace process on TV, like marketed to me, and then I watched it blow up, the last remnants of it under Trump and whatever. So I guess for me, and that's what I've known is the West Bank Fatah that doesn't have elections, that, like, that's basically a kind of an agent for, I mean, some people say this, I'm not Palestinian, so what right do I have to accuse to meddle in internal Palestinian politics? It's interesting though that, the moment that Palestinians did a bit of democracy and they democratically voted in a government in a place like Gaza is the moment where the knives really came out for them, where their economies were more besieged and they were treated like, other threatening rogue nations like Iran and Venezuela, which is actually proof that's a higher stage of, say, liberation than I think you could say about Fatah. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, these situations more, you're obviously
Well,
more
they're
invested in this.
different.
Me.
Sina, what you're fundamentally saying is that you remember George Foreman for the grill, not for how amazing of a
That's true.
heavyweight fighter
That's
he
true.
was. And that's Fatah's story, right? I don't love or hate either of these groups. I don't have emotions about them. But when I look at them, I try to look as realistically as possible at what their successes and what their failures are. Fatah created, in a lot of ways, the Palestinian liberation movement, and Fatah created a space internationally for us to talk about even what Palestine is. Yes, now they're selling George Foreman grills, right? And they're getting knocked out in the ring. Yeah, but don't forget that there was a really powerful boxer in there for quite a while.
I
That did
mean,
accomplish some things.
Yasser Arafat at the end tried to do the right thing, and it cost him his life, really. Like, he tried to, I don't know, maybe there's a different way to read the ending of Yasser Arafat's life. Maybe that's a different conversation. But
Yeah,
it's a
I'll be honest that I don't know enough about Arafat to really say. I don't pay that much attention to these guys, because I'm not interested in George Foreman grills, right? Like, it's just
You have bigger
so.
fish to fry, so to speak. But I guess maybe we could talk a little bit about the medical work because, you obviously have traveled to different kinds of places to practice these skills that you've attained as a medical doctor. Is there a particular angle that you think working in medicine gives you to sort of seeing revolutionary struggle? Is it a different kind of solidarity? Like, what? I mean, you also had your own experiences too, specifically with the resistance in Gaza. I mean, with, facing down what Palestinians have to face down in Gaza. You weren't just there working, right? So it might be interesting to kind of have you explore these issues broadly and in a general sense and dive into whatever you want to.
Medicine for me was really an avenue to engage with the struggle that I felt suited me and suited the struggle. So there has to, in there's this saying that like there are four things you need. I never really forget most of them. To kind of be happy in a job. One of them, it's like al-wahba wal-mehna wal-fursa, I think it is, you know, the desire, the ability, and the opportunity. And so here, when looking at medicine, like those three things, I guess there's a fourth, but I don't remember it, are there. They're present. And that's one of the main reasons why I went into medicine. I realized even at the time that I could be a street sweeper in a place like Gaza or in a place like the West Bank. It was the West Bank that I worked in when I kind of decided to do medicine. And you can be just a street sweeper and still accomplish a lot because revolutionary struggle isn't about advanced degrees. It's about compassion. It's about the ability to be in solidarity. And I won't divide that solidarity into classes. It's not more valuable solidarity to be a doctor than to be an observer or to be a lover of the cause from halfway across the struggle. These are all essential kinds of solidarity that shouldn't be divided. For me, the magic moment kind of really happened in terms of both realizing what kind of medicine I wanted to do and the fact that I wanted to always be involved. It was when I was in a market that got bombed in Jenin. And everybody starts running and shouting, and I start running and shouting, screaming. And there's dust everywhere, and nobody can see anything. And as the literal dust starts to settle, I realize, like, oh my God, everybody else ran away from the explosion. I ran towards the explosion. I realize, oh my God, now I'm here. It was me and just a couple of people with these people who are injured, and I don't know what to do. And that is a literal situation in which I needed to learn skills to take care of injured people, but it was also a bit of a metaphor because I had shown up to the West Bank. This was in Jenin with friend of the pod, Justin Poder, actually. And we had met and traveled to Jenin together that year. I had realized that I kind of engaged Palestine without knowing anything about it. I didn't grow up in a family that talked a lot about the political history. As a Palestinian, everybody has an automatic poli-sci degree, but we didn't engage the topics very deeply. And so I didn't know
Why do you
very
think that is,
much.
if you don't mind me asking? Is that like, is it a painful thing for families to just to dredge up? Is it just the nature of some families versus other families?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of trauma in being a Palestinian. And my father was expelled from Palestine in 1948 as a baby, and then witnessed some of the war in Lebanon, and then was expelled from Kuwait for being a Palestinian in
Wow.
1990.
Wow.
My mother lived, was born into a refugee camp in what was at the time Palestine. It was the West Bank. And then when she was a girl, saw the troops, the Israeli troops, occupy that refugee camp. When I tell my parents that I'm going to go camping, sometimes I go camping with a tent and all that, they look at me and they're so puzzled and they ask, they say, "We worked so hard to get you out of a tent. What are you doing?" And that is literally what it's like emotionally. They worked so hard to get me away from being a refugee, to get me away from the war. They're so incredibly proud of me, they really are. But I think at the same time, they wish that I didn't do the work that I did, or that I didn't, maybe a better way to put it, that I didn't have to do the work that I did. Because they never wanted me to know what a gunshot was. They never wanted me to know what an explosion was. I was on the phone once with my mother while I was being literally directly shot at. I was behind a sand barrier. And she called, and I didn't want her to freak out, you know. And she almost instantly recognized the pattern of the gunfire behind me. And I was like, "No, no, no, it's fireworks." She knew. Obviously, we shared the lie together that it was just fireworks, but she knew. Why? Why did she know? That's not something, as I think about it, I'm now at that age where I'm thinking about kids, and as I think about my own kids, I don't want them to know that either. So I think that was why our home was a place that was relatively devoid of that. We couldn't avoid it. I mean, both my uncle and my grandfather spent years in jail and basically fundamentally died engaging with the occupation, in jails. So you can't avoid that, and you don't want to avoid that. But at the same time, it just, at what point do you start talking to your kids about what's up, what's happening, and all of that? So I think that's the why.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. It's a meandering conversation, my favorite
That's cool.
kind.
And you did say friend of the pod. Technically, you can't say friend of the pod. Only I can say friend of the pod. But since you are actually a friend of the pod, you can say friend of
Been given
the
friend of the pod privileges.
pod. Yeah.
Incredible.
Justin Potter is the greatest friend of this podcast. He's great. But we were talking about medicine, and we were and so part and then the conversation did head towards militancy, right? I mean, we didn't use that word, but that's the question, right? Like, when you're facing down, like it's like a simple philosophical kind of like Hegelian problem, right? You have this thesis, which is Palestinians want to free their homeland, and then you have this antithesis, which is this thing called the IDF. Right, which is one of the most well-funded, well-protected kind of like vaunted colonial occupation forces to have ever existed in the history of humanity. Like, I can't think of another analogy. I mean, I guess the British military is not the same. It is an occupying force in different countries, but the uniqueness of the Zionist sort of story is that it's this immense, I want to say global project in its senses that it does pull in a sort of global population to support it, and it kind of tells a global story, or pretends to at least. But ultimately, it's a very small thing, right? In terms of numbers, we're not talking a huge, huge numbers of people, right? We're talking about, under 12 million, 13 million in historic Palestine. So it's a kind of localized conflict, and it's interesting that, your own presence in this and your own location, as someone who's like, you said it before, like, you're not a nationalist. Right, like at least I don't know if you phrase it that way, but you were like, I don't care about Palestine, like the idea of Palestine. Like for you, it's I imagine it's practical, it's liberation, it's like ending, humiliation and land theft. Right, it's like something very practical. It's not, a flag, a textile. Right, like so some people it is, but for you personally, it's something else. But I guess the way that and obviously your skills as a doctor became the kind of avenue for your participation in that. Now, because of your medical skills, because of health, like the skills you have, and specifically that they come in handy when you have a question of militancy, right? Like there's no, we don't really need medics in like, protest movements in wherever, right? Like the Extinction Rebellion kids, whatever they're doing, like don't need to have these medics, but like Palestinians protesting for their freedom, like protesting at like, the Great March of Return need medics because they get shot at, they get murdered. Right. And so, like, there's a very practical thing you do in terms of how you have done your solidarity or imagined your solidarity. But could Palestine actually be underneath this also? That, like, even if you don't, if it's not your motivating principle, but that the history and the memory of that loss has activated something in you, almost like an allergic response. Like, you didn't make money. You didn't go and become a, what's the nose surgery, rhinoplasty? Like you didn't, you could have done that, couldn't you? Couldn't you have done that and like done well for yourself? Like, couldn't you have become an orthodontist and done well for yourself and like not have to, get shot at by Israeli troops?
Okay, so if it's okay, I'll engage with quite a few. You bring up a lot of stuff. I want to engage with all of it. So I think we're going to hit a few different threads here. First thing to say though is that I am doing really well for myself. So you're right that I could have more financial means, but like doctors in Canada right now are in a really special place. I take 4 months off a year to travel and do this stuff, and I still live fabulously well. You know, I have cold orange juice with pulp in my fridge. Like I basically have made it, financially speaking. So it's there are a lot of costs, but having said that, I don't struggle in the same way that so many people do or would if they decided that they wanted to do the same thing. I'm not in any meaningful way sacrificing my financial ability and integrity so that I can go and do this. You're of course absolutely right that the Palestinian part and my Palestinian experience as a refugee really does mean something, and it really does propel me forward because I see the suffering of my parents. I remember the suffering of my grandmother, who my grandmothers who are both dead now. I remember their stories and the tragedies of their lives. My grandmother, when I graduated from medicine, I saw her. And well, actually, she had died just before then. But you know, when I was finishing up medicine, I saw her, and she said, "You know, my child, go and be a doctor, but when we get the farm back, your job is growing olives." I was like, "Yeah, yes, it's okay." And it's not that I can ever really go and become an olive farmer for probably a million reasons, but it's that. She got stuck there by her trauma. She never left 1948. She was never really able to. She raised kids and she lived life and she did everything she could, but that trauma is forever. You mentioned you're framing things in a really interesting way when you talk about the Zionists. When I go from Israel to Gaza, obviously I land in Ben Gurion Airport. It's the only place I'm allowed to enter from right now. And then I usually take the train, and almost always I'm surrounded by soldiers who are going to or coming back from their duty on the southern border. There's lots of guns, there's lots of fatigues, there's lots of boots. They're all super young. I can guarantee you that more than half of any given train car I'm in does not contain Zionist soldiers. Like, those are not Zionist soldiers. Those are just soldiers. And I learned this talking to American soldiers in Iraq and Israeli soldiers. This may be a Zionist project, but I don't think that means that everybody in it is Zionist or that even most people in it are Zionist. And I think that that's one of the most interesting things about these struggles is that the foot soldiers of struggle are not ideologues. They do not, they may care about the safety of their families, but that doesn't make an Israeli soldier Zionist. You know, they have no idea what exactly they're doing on a grand scale. And I think that that's probably even true on a larger scale than we care to admit. So yes, there's an animating political philosophy here, but I think it's probably it probably gets us a bit lost to talk about it in as narrow terms as to call it Zionism, because I don't see a difference between the way that Israeli foot soldiers, grunts behave, and also the way in which Israeli politicians behave. And when I worked in Colombia, the same thing there, like the Israeli or sorry, the Colombian paramilitaries who I saw and talked to, or the Colombian, you know, like just regular soldiers at Ejercicio who like do that. They all look and sound and behave the same. And I think that not to over universalize it too, because I know that that's something that's important is recognizing that moment. But I do think that the more we can connect those struggles, the more we can learn from the other places, and the more that we can create effective tactics and also take resistance strategies and apply them, which clearly is one of the things that has worked very, very well for the Palestinian resistance, both armed and unarmed, is that they've recognized some of the factors that are at work here and co-opted and extended some of the strategies. BDS is not a native Palestinian strategy. It's an imported one. And obviously, the way that Hamas approaches military armed resistance and even their unarmed resistance, these are all concepts that were extended in Gaza but developed elsewhere.
Well, maybe we can sort of go back to the Gaza political situation for a second too, because, you know, this is something that, you know, I kind of harp on a lot, is that this strange contradiction of that Gaza having, you know, more national sovereignty than the West Bank, which has more, let's say, state legitimacy, if that makes sense, because the people with the ability to deem certain states legitimate and other states illegitimate are the people who, you know, imbue the Palestinian Authority with a certain, at least the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, with a certain kind of power, right? With the Oslo, whatever. So, like, there's an interesting situation here where the people who run the Gaza Strip are, as I said, democratically elected. They have more of a popular base. And there's actually more, like, there seems to be at least more political culture in a place like Gaza than there is in the West Bank because of the kind of necrotic elite politics that, at least from where I can see it as an outsider, you know, watching this for the last, you know, 20 years post intifada, right? Like, where I can see it is that Hamas has, or and the factions in Gaza have achieved something in terms of establishing a deterrent with the Zionists, and in a real sense saying to the world that, like, you can't just invade us and stomp on us, like, it's gonna hurt you if you keep doing this. And so I feel that it's good to explore the meaning of Gaza and its relationship to the West Bank and the Palestinian struggle, because the sort of Jerusalem, right? Like, this was by linking the two struggles, right? Because essentially what, there wasn't anything happening in Gaza at the time, right? If you remember, is that it's like, obviously you remember, I was talking to the audience, but like, this is that they link the struggle and said, if you attack our mosque, like, if you attack our holy sites, like, that's Palestine too. We defend that too. So, like, even in that act itself of saying that we will take huge blows in defending this, in showing the Zionists that we're serious about our sites, way more than, I have to say, Fatah, you know, way more than them, obviously. And so there isn't a weird, can you kind of, if you can, kind of give us a political overlay of the relationship between the Gaza to West Bank and the Palestine struggle, kind of triangulate those three for us.
You're absolutely right that the system in Gaza has created something really, really special. And almost the biggest accusation against groups like Hamas, or just generally the Palestinians, when they do some of these resistance acts, is that there's a benefit to them as well. So, for example, people look at Hamas and they say, well, Hamas defended this or that, or they bombed this or that. Well, that made them more popular with Gazans at home. That's why they did it. Of course, that's true. When Palestinians see any resistance group standing up for them and defending them after they are being treated like a punching bag, they value more highly that group of people. But that's not the why. I can more or less guarantee you that's not the why that people are engaged in it, especially in a place like Gaza, where Hamas has relatively few advantages to offer its fighters as compared to other groups or people. If they're not doing something that the people generally believe in, then the people will abandon them. It's, in fact, not to say, oh, Hamas got dragged into this. They didn't. Of course not. They're a resistance movement. They make their decisions. They do their thing. However, they really are in a position where the people are mad. The people were super angry. I think we probably, because so much has happened in 2021, it feels like an eternity ago. But it's easy to forget how upset and how attacked the Palestinians felt over what was happening in Jerusalem at the time. These were their people. The Israelis divided us into groups of Palestinians, into the four main groups: the refugees outside the country, the 1948 Palestinians, the West Bank Palestinians, and the Gaza Palestinians. We never divided ourselves. We never accepted that division as Palestinians. And people know that. And so when Jerusalem was being attacked in its own way, then the Palestinians demanded a response, and they got one. They got one from Hamas. I think that when it comes to Palestinian resistance, it really is one of those things where there has been an underestimation of how much solidarity is between the different factions of Palestinians. Even the Fatah-Hamas struggle, as ugly as it is, it's an internal family struggle. And it doesn't impact the end result that wherever they're allowed to, Palestinians do resist the occupation heavily. And I think that was actually something that was really valuable to see. The Palestinians in the West Bank weren't sitting idle. The Palestinians in Jerusalem weren't sitting idle. The Palestinians in 48 weren't sitting idle while Gaza did everything. Yeah, the center of resistance sometimes changes from maybe Egypt to Lebanon to Jordan to the West Bank to Gaza, but it never means that there's any quiet part of that resistance. I've never seen there to be a quiet part of the resistance, as much as there are those attempts to divide us.
Well, the Gaza phase of the resistance, though, has been the most potent, though, at the, you know, like there is that this the development of Palestinian resistance hasn't been has been very uneven, let's say, in the sense that, you know, look at, I mean, I'm sure you're old enough to remember the First Intifada. The First Intifada was famously nonviolent, right? Or I mean, I guess supposedly, right? Like there were that, but like generally compared to the Second Intifada, at least, that there was a lot less militant resistance, right? And now by the time, like I don't know what like a third intifada looks like. Like it seems like we're past the point of intifada. I mean, I don't know what that even means at this point because of the nature of the occupation, because of what's happened, the different developments is that on the one hand you have the liberation of Gaza and its subsequent enclosure and besiege. And its besiegement, is that even a word? Besiegal? besiegemification. And then on the other hand, you have
I
the
like
West
it.
Bank, which was blue checkified and normified and and flooded with money from the Gulf, from the UAE, from Qatar, you know, like just so it's an interesting kind of, dynamic to think about, right? Like all these developments. These huge military developments, political, sort of geopolitical developments, these have happened since Oslo, I would say, that like the real changing of the game and the map and the intensification of the Zionist assault and what's remaining of Palestine has also happened, right? Like it feels like the Palestinians have upped the contradictions that the Israelis have to contend with, right? Because think about it, right? Like you move into this foreign land. And you make yourself at home, you try to kick out as many of the indigenous people as you can through terror and whatever. It doesn't work, right? Like 48 didn't work, like the War of 48 and like the lead up to it. And so a lot of the Palestinians stayed and made lives for themselves. And they remained a kind of burden on the Zionist project, right? Like it just can't go away, these people. And so it's interesting now to see the developments in my time sort of as watching it as an adult, especially from the Second Intifada onwards, which was supposedly a failure, right? Like when people sort of look at it now, it sort of seemed looked at as a failure because, like, what did you get out of it? But then you think about Gaza and you think about the resistance and their ability to, say, forge links with their allies, specifically Iran. That is something that, like, I think people forget when they talk about Gaza because they only see, not only, but like, the tragedy and the violence and all that stuff. I mean, I'm repeating myself something I've said earlier, but it strikes me as so, it's such a powerful irony that here is this small strip of land that for a lot of people represents the most, like, what's the word I'm looking for? The most dispossessed and the most subaltern of the Palestinians, you could say, you're tempted to say. However, they've proven to be the ones with the most power in the classical sense of in imposing your will on a much stronger enemy, supposedly.
I totally agree with you that this is an incredible phase of the struggle for liberation. I 100% do. Where I would like to push back is that there's something absolutely extraordinary in terms of the amplitude or the importance of this phase of the struggle. When I think, for example, of my grandfather was not a particularly important or particularly potent individual. He was just a regular citizen. He was jailed by the Israelis, of course, but also by the British back in the day for resisting. When we look at the Palestinian struggle, every phase has been incredible. Right from the attempt of just the regular peasants in 48 to push back against the onslaught and against the dispossession, through to the 50s and 60s as the Fedayeen were developing, you know, to what happened in Egypt when Fatah was forming, and then everything in the 80s coming through, just like you said, to the First Intifada. The First Intifada was not less significant than the current moment. The First Intifada gave us the Oslo Accords. That the Oslo Accords were a negotiation failure, but what created the fertile ground on which they could even happen in the first place was that First Intifada. That's really extraordinary. It's not more extraordinary than today, but it's not less. What happened as well in Operation Defensive Shield in the early 2000s, that was really extraordinary too. That's amazing. You know, when you look at personalities like George Habesh, not relating it to the early 2000s, but just in general, they were just as impressive as anything that's happening in Gaza now. Leila Khaled, the what was it? Who was it, like the Red Army from Japan or something that like went around and did pro-Palestinian actions? I mean, that was also another incredible phase of the Palestinian resistance. Say what you want to about the various ethics or whatnot. Like these are all parts of, if you wanted to put it, like the greatest hits. This particular phase of the resistance, it will pass too. What will it pass into and how will it pass? That we don't really know right now. I think even the clearest thinkers aren't entirely sure what happens next. But having said that, what Gaza does today is built on what all of the Palestinian resistance did in the last 70 years or 100 years, even, because I would trace it really back to at least 1936. And it also builds the struggle that comes next. Because also when maybe Hamas ends up becoming a totally useless or corrupted part of the resistance at some point, that doesn't take away from what they, as both a political movement and as their military wing, as Izzeddin al-Qassam, has accomplished. Now, that doesn't take away from that. And also, it doesn't mean that the work that they're doing now is the work that always has to be done. Because at a certain point, we have to transition. In fact, the irony, you know, when people tell me that they don't like Hamas, I have to speak very, very carefully because I work in Gaza. I can't exactly speak openly about how I feel about Hamas, the same way, frankly, that I can't exactly speak openly about how I feel about, let's say, this hospital's administration or this university's administration that I'm at. Like, that there's nothing new about that. Anybody who works in an official capacity understands that. But the best way you can totally destroy Hamas is to liberate Palestine. The Palestinians will have no need for liberation struggle if they're free. And that's the deepest irony. And that's what immediately exposes the fact that people are not interested in the freedom of Palestinians when they often talk about the oppression of Hamas. And oh yeah, there's very real oppression to Hamas. I think we have to recognize that too. But if you want to liberate it, the way to liberate it is to remove the conditions that drive people to desperate extremes.
So you've experienced something very common for Palestinians, which is an encounter with an Israeli bullet. Can you share for our listeners what happened and the aftermath of it for you? And it's kind of, you kind of made lemons. I mean, life kind of gave you lemons and you've made lemonade with it, so to speak, at least with your interest in 3D printing prosthetics. So maybe we can kind of shift into that phase of the conversation in terms of in terms of what a doctor can do to help liberation? Because it seems like that seems to be one of the answers to that question that you're enacting.
When we first engaged with the idea of medicine in Palestine, one of the things that immediately became apparent is that you need at least these three major factors to get a good Palestinian system going. One of them is that you needed the doctors to be trained well. And that was at the time missing because so much Palestinian medical training involved going outside Palestine. There wasn't an indigenous Palestinian medical education system in 2006. The other thing, okay, so I first engaged with Palestinian health in that way. I started educating people and teaching with this super colonialist sort of approach, I'm ashamed to say, in which I was like, oh, well, I have the best education in the world. If I just give it to the Palestinians, everything will be fine. And of course, part of that is true. This education is amazing. And as I was starting to teach, people would be like, okay, yeah, but that it's great that we know how to do things, but we don't have the actual equipment to do things. And so we didn't end up 3D printing just for the hell of it. First, we tried because Egypt was open. We tried to smuggle in things like stethoscopes. And even before that, we tried to bring in officially things like beds. Like if you try to bring medical devices or medical equipment into Gaza through Israel, it has to pass through the port of Ashdod. And it undergoes a very, very lengthy inspection regime. And back then, in the early 2010s, they would very often leave your gear opened and outside. And over 8-12 months, that means that it's exposed to winter, to rain, to everything. And very often, by the time you get the gear approved, it's totally ruined and destroyed. And this happened with medical beds, and this happened with all kinds of electronic equipment. And I remember we raised a ton of money for some stuff, and the stuff was all bad when it arrived like a year later. So we're like, okay, well, the Israeli border isn't going to work out. Like, let's do it through the Egyptian border. And of course, that means smuggling through the tunnels at the time. But the tunnels there were basically semi-official. There even used to be a Ministry of Tunnels. Just
what? What? Yeah. Really? That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, the Palestinian government had a Ministry of Tunnels.
It's like a mole. It's like the symbol is like a mole.
That's like hilarious.
With a goofy on it.
Well, you have to think about it, right? There were 1,800 tunnels. There had to be a ministry to manage what was coming in, going out. There had to be a ministry to make sure they were safe. So they would send engineers in to check the structural integrity of the tunnels. By the end, the tunnels were...
I mean, that's
were...
amazing. I have to say this. That is so amazing. It's like something out of a novel. Like digging tunnels, hundreds, like over 1,000, almost 2,000 tunnels to like get in the stuff that your occupier, oppressor, besieger doesn't want to let you live. So you're like, okay, I guess we're going to have to figure out a new way. Like it really is like, it's like Jeff Goldblum, like life finds a way. Like you can't suffocate people. Like they will resist and they will find creative ways to get the things they need.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what we kind of saw. And so we tried that. But the problem with the tunnels was that it was too subject to the whims of the Egyptians. And even in the Morsi days, he was the prime minister who was overthrown by Sisi, who was elected after Mubarak ended up basically being deposed. So even in the Morsi, the like, in quotation marks, best Morsi days, still you had a very temperamental regime with the tunnels, where one day it would be open, one day it would be closed. And really the conclusion that we came up to is unless you could produce domestically, you had no independence over the medical devices. And that's when we finally turned to local production. And at that time, when you're talking about 2013, 2014, 3D printing was very, very primitive. It was very primitive. It wasn't super high quality. It wasn't super fast. It wasn't super reliable. And so when we started that project, we didn't actually know that it could succeed. All we knew was that it was worth trying. And first, of course, just because it's easier, lots of the R&D happened in Canada. What we did was we tried to manipulate and invert the usual medical device development model. So usually the medical device development model is that you create a device here, sure, or as is more commonly the case now, you pay for it with really well-educated, really poorly paid, especially Indian and Chinese engineers. And then you take the devices that are created, and you test them heavily against Black, Brown, and Indigenous people all across the world. So almost all drugs nowadays, almost all medical devices are primarily tested on poor, defenseless people. Instead, and then of course, the devices, their utility and the profit from them all goes back to the first world. What we've done is we've kind of flipped that over. The development happens as a mix between Canada and Gaza or wherever else. And then the research and testing, with one really important exception that I'll come back to in a moment, all happens in Canada. Because, of course, the cost of testing is much less in Canada. Not cost money-wise, it's way more expensive, but the cost in terms of human pain, suffering, injury, etc. So, for example, when we're testing the pulse oximeter, there's a possibility that I end up going too far. This is the thing that detects somebody's oxygen, and the way you test it incredibly is that you basically suffocate people. You basically deprive them of oxygen, and then you monitor them using two different methods, including this pulse oximeter that we're making. Well, I'm able to do that in an intensive care unit. Obviously, we've stopped for COVID, but an intensive care unit in Canada. The injuries that I can cause will be detected sooner, and if, God forbid, something happens, I'll be able to treat it immediately with the best resources, and then if also, God forbid, there's a permanent injury, it's in a place that can take care of that person. So that's the model that we've been using. And in the end, we don't need the device to be super tiny. We just need it to be easy to reproduce. So we've mixed these things that make the device very easy to create there, one of them being that we use a completely open source development process, where we take other people's work that they have open sourced for us, we develop it rather than starting from zero, and then hopefully when we're done, we release all of that source code through various communities, including the peer-reviewed science community, for other people to use as they see fit. After that, we also use production that is local. So, you know, we can have a device that's 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters rather than 4 centimeters by 4 centimeters, but is easy to produce using whatever circuitry and chips are available routinely in a place like Gaza. And there is a lot of stuff that's available there. And then, of course, the other thing is that because it is so easy to make yourself, you can produce it for your market to your needs. I mentioned that we test in Canada. The one exception to that was the tourniquet. With the tourniquet, when the Great March of Return started, we anticipated that there'd be a problem, so we accelerated work we were already doing on the tourniquet. The tourniquet is a device that you put around an arm or a leg to squeeze them so that they stop bleeding when a person's going to bleed to death. So we accelerated the work, but all of the development happened in Gaza. And then when it came time for testing, well, 1,000 people were shot in March. And I forget exactly how many died that particular day. I think it was 20 or 30. We needed to accelerate this thing right into the field immediately. And that sucks. That sucks. You should never have to deploy a device that you haven't tested well. But we sat there. I sat with the ethics of it. We all talked about it. And we decided this was kind of the way that we had to do it. The device mostly worked, somewhat failed. We redeveloped it several times. But ultimately, it was a great success story of the development process. It was an impossible-to-import device because the real tourniquets are called CATS, combat application tourniquets. The Israelis look at the word combat and they're like, no, not allowed. They consider it basically dual use. They don't consider it a medical device. So we had to produce it domestically. We had to produce it in as big a scale as we could. And initially, that scale was not very huge because it took us time to work out the kinks of mass mass production. And in the end, countless people were treated with it. I can't tell you, I know people love language of like, oh, it saved lives. I mean, I can't tell you that. But what I can tell you is that we treated hundreds of people, and the rate of death of limb exsanguination, dying from bleeding from a shot leg or shot arm, was basically zero. It was way lower than the international standards. It's way lower than what it would be in Canada. There's lots of factors for that, but the tourniquet was definitely one of them.
Sorry, I muted myself. But what happened to you though? Because you learned, you got shot. Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but you're okay. So
Yeah, I am
we can
okay.
laugh now.
Well, that particular day, that was May 14th, 2018, to kind of bring people back into it, the March of Return had been going on for just under 2 months. And it was clear that the Israelis had no hesitancy to shoot. But up until that point, no medical people had been shot, no medics of any kind had been shot. So, and I was actually the first medic shot at all. So I had no reason to believe that the Israelis were ready and willing to shoot medics when I got shot. When the people were there, it was, by every definition that we understand now, nonviolent. I think if you would have gone back to before the BLM movement's gains in the past year and a half, 2 years, people might have thought that throwing rocks was an act of violence. People in places like Portland really helped us redefine this word nonviolence to include basically things like throwing some stones here and there, yelling, shouting, singing. There were very few Israeli soldiers hurt and none, as far as I know, shot. I don't really remember if there were any people who were shot on the Israeli side from the Palestinian side. But that's not for lack of Palestinian guns. Palestinians are fucking flush with guns. Even regular families sometimes will have guns.
Yeah, they
But
chose to make the Great March nonviolent, and look what they got for their troubles.
they chose to make it nonviolent. And there was that decision was reaffirmed time and time again. After March 30th, I think the expectation that the Israelis had was that the Palestinians would start trying to shoot back, and that would then give them more permission to go and do their thing. And the Palestinians have a rich history of nonviolent resistance, the First Intifada being one example, but so many other examples, all the way back to, the general strikes of the 1930s. So yeah, it was they made that decision again and again and again. And the atmosphere always was super festive. Yes, there were parts where people were throwing rocks or getting shot or whatever, but primarily it was a reclamation of space. The Israelis, what most people don't really know about this, is that the Israelis had created a kill zone for hundreds of meters from the wall. And the Palestinians went up and set up circuses and tents and did theater and had balloons. And they retook some of that space, and they started to do the one thing that is considered to be the act of resistance and reclamation for the Palestinians. They started planting the fields. They hadn't been able to do that for a very, very long time. And they closed that buffer down from several hundred meters to 100 meters. And that's the area where there was always that tension. So when I was there, basically, I'd woken up knowing that there would be some issues. I put in my earbud. Basically, we all would engage with FM radio back then, and that's how you knew exactly what was going on. I mean, that's still true today, actually. When the shit really gets hot, you're not checking your phone. You just got an earbud in, tuned into one of the channels, and just like there's traffic reports of slowdowns on the Highway 401, they would report where the bombings or the shootings or whatever is happening. And I woke up relatively early at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I put in my earbud, and already by that point, there had been shootings, and I believe I forget the exact timeline now. There's been so much life since then, but there had been one person killed already, which is something. I mean, that was early in the day. I was like, whoa, okay, this shit is gonna get serious. So I got myself together. I went to the border area. I had all of the tourniquets available in that part of Gaza for the day, which was, I believe, 60 something tourniquets. And the shootings were crazy. I mean, there were so many shootings that I basically stopped going to most of them. I would only go if somebody was shot in the chest or the head, because those are really the two scenarios where I may be of use as a doctor. And other than that, it was mostly the other paramedic teams. And I would go if, like, it was obviously a really bad bleed, or if it was obviously a chest or abdominal wound, or I could do something. And obviously, there were ebbs and flows. People would sometimes light tires on fire, people would sometimes do things. But that's not when most people were getting shot. Most people who were shot were standing when they got shot. They weren't moving. Because, of course, you kind of realize these are kids. They're 19, 20, 21, whatever, something like this. And they're lazy, just like the rest of us. And so they're going to shoot at stop targets, not at moving targets. I mean, do you know how hard it is to hit a moving target? So it wasn't really a surprise in retrospect, now knowing what I know now, that when they shot me, I was standing still, doing nothing with no smoke. There were no barriers for the sniper because barriers make shooting harder.
They
So,
don't need a reason. They just want to shoot. Like, the point is to shoot and to show their power. I mean, we have this, I think we have this idea that, like, some kind of law governs the police and military of whatever, right? Like, but
do you
like,
really think, though, Sina, that that soldier who shot me was calculating the power dynamics? I mean, that guy probably thought I was there to kill him and his family.
I don't know. I think you give too much credit. I think you give too much. I think some people genuinely they like killing Palestinians. I've seen videos, like
Yeah, but
it's a sadism of a colonial occupier.
I don't think that's the majority. And I think when you see that, like at this point, I've had this weird, unique privilege of having shaken hands with a lot of fucking killers. And they're almost always in army uniform, right? I've met Iraqi soldiers, I met Lebanese soldiers, I met American soldiers in Iraq, and I met a lot of Israeli soldiers. I met Israeli soldiers who had their gun to my head. And it was always my sense that that thing you're talking about, that like, I want to kill you, it's a result, not a cause. It's a result of the dehumanization. It's a result of the fear. These guys are
Yes,
fucking terrified.
I agree with you that it's the end, it's the final act of a very long and old process of racialization, orientalism, imperialism, like all these forces that enact on every single individual in this world. It's just the relationship to power that enactment, that's what it makes depends on. If you're an object of power or if you're a subject of power. In the case of the Israelis, they have all the cards. They're protected by a state which is protected by essentially all the entire global institution of the West and all their allies. On the other side, you have Palestinians, like indigenous Palestinians, whose lives are determined to be sacrificial, that it's okay to murder them. So
And out of 1700 people who were shot the day that I was shot, my name is probably the only name that anybody could give. And that's for a million reasons. There was this UN investigation, and I was and what's called a named witness, because of course most people were terrified to be named. And even the other named Palestinian witnesses, they couldn't appear in Geneva to give testimony. I was the only face and the only name that could be there, because I was the only one who was real to them. I was the only actual person to them. And that has a lot to do with my whiteness. Whiteness is sometimes conferred, and it's been conferred on me by my level of education, by the fact that I speak without an accent. Like I get all of that. And I understand that, that was why I had this tremendous privilege, which also turns, of course, you sort of mentioned about leveraging that moment. I mean, that was my obligation. When I was shot, that conferred upon me a responsibility to tell people what I had seen that day and what had happened that day. And I remember when I spoke to the Canadian government, it was a minister in the Canadian government, and this person says to me, "Oh, well, do you want us to call for an inquiry?" This was like an actual elected politician who was pretty high up. I said no. And this person was shocked. Like, just you could hear the gasp on the other side of the phone. Here I
Yeah, as
was,
if an inquiry
literally.
is going to do anything. Shut up, white people. Next. Next. Oh, could we sit down and have a meeting about this? If we have Has anybody thought of having a meeting about what's happening in Palestine? Maybe if we talk about it, we'll get something done. Gosh.
Well, yeah, clearly it would have to be a cross-disciplinary panel. But yeah, I mean, that was you're right. It's funny because your audience, of course, will have passed through these experiences and understand the futility of lots of these processes. But the average Canadian would have jumped at that opportunity and been like, "Yes, let's make this about me. Let's talk about the failures that led to my shooting." And instead, what I asked for and what I wanted was money for the Palestinian healthcare system. And actually, my ask was $15 million, which, to sort of and now do a little bit of postmortem now that we're a few years out, everybody said yes to. Nobody said no to me on that one, right up to Prime Minister Trudeau. And after that, of course, we as a movement weren't able to do the things that were needed to operationalize that cash. And once the pressure was gone, the money was gone. So I wish that I would have known a little bit more. Even that today, I don't think I would be able to be in the same situation and turn that commitment into actual cash. But that's a serious failure of our movement, is that there was this moment, there was this promise, there was this thing. And yes, we did do a lot with it. We were able to take this terrible incident. Like, don't get me wrong, I would give up all of those political gains to not have been shot. I did not want to get fucking shot. I do not want to get fucking shot. It was one
Did
of the
it
most
hurt?
terrible. Of course it fucking hurt. What are you talking about?
I mean, what kind of pain was it? Like, the thing that doctors say, was it out of top 10? What, the top scale of 1 to 10? What was it? Sorry, I'm just being a dick. I'm just making fun of you because these are the things that doctors say. Like, how did it feel? Oh, it was hurting. It felt like pain.
The here you do you do well to challenge the pain scale, but yeah, it was obviously terrible, but I was also super lucky. This person went for both of my knees and missed, didn't miss, but like missed causing the worst damage in both of them. I could have very easily ended up an amputee or a double amputee, although that would have been very unlikely because I would have had access to Canadian healthcare.